A groundbreaking feminist, a consistent contrarian, and a woman who has left a social legacy for generations. Nell McCafferty was one of a kind. This is how Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland announced her passing on Wednesday.
And it is with immense sadness that we announce this morning the death of journalist, trailblazing feminist and founding member of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, Nell McCafferty. She was 80. To my generation of journalists, she was an inspiration, and in her writing about social injustice, from the Irish courts to the Kerry Babies case, she made a huge contribution to significant changes for women in Irish society. Let's hear a little more about her life and stellar journalistic career.
I hear Mike Murphy, Gay Byrne, Rodney Rice, John Bowman, Liam Nolan, and I've had them up to there. Gay, it goes on year after year after year. Woman, do not exist in radio. We are an invisible species.
Susan McKay, press ombudsman, former journalist and fellow Derry woman. Good morning. How will you remember Nell?
Just as an absolute phenomenon. She was really brilliant journalist, and she transformed journalism in Ireland, and she opened all sorts of ways of writing for me and other women of my generation and also generations to come. She really was brilliant, and she was in a class of her own, and she kind of brought south, you know, a blast of northern air. You know, she talked about how Bloody Sunday in Derry had transformed the lives of everybody in the North at that time, and she brought that sensibility to the Republic, and she really shook things up.
On the News at One, Rachel English paid her own tribute.
For many growing up in the Ireland of the 1970s and 80s, so important was her voice that she was known simply as Nell. She first came to public prominence in 1971 when she was on what became known as the Contraceptive Train. A group from the Irish Women's Liberation Movement travelled to Belfast, where it was possible to buy contraceptives.
The idea came up we should import contraceptives, break the taboo, break the ban. We decided to take a train to the north, get the contraceptives, bring them back. We were doing what was called International Media Day. So it would be a great opportunity for publicity. Very easy story for the international media to do woman, sex, Catholic Church, Catholic State. It was what they call a sexy story.
Right now we're going to split up into groups. Some people want to go to the family planning clinic. Some people will then go on to the chemist shop.
People's minds change. It was like flipping an electric switch. Once it goes on in your head, it goes on in your head, it never goes off again. The people on the whole said, this is a good idea, this pill. We were the start of the biggest revolution of Ireland, separating church and state.
One of Nell's journalistic high points was her coverage of the Kerry Babies case, which she handled with fierce honesty, even when it came to assessing her own presence in court. As she told Alan Tourney in a 2015 interview, which was replayed this week.
They were slavering in court. And the question asked was, by a prosecuting lawyer, did Joanne Hayes love this man who impregnated her, or did she just love what men were prepared to do with her? It was horrendous. And she was so sick on the stand that she had to be sedated. The judge ordered her to be sedated. We heard her out in the corridor retching and crying. She was brought in sedated, so heavily sedated, that her head kept bobbing off the microphone. And I blame myself here. I sometimes think, why didn't I stand up and say this is illegal? And I didn't. I was intimidated like everybody else. And the judge then advised Joanne's friends to bring her home to sleep in their house that night because he thought she was suicidal. That was the Kerry Babies case. And we all sat there stunned. And it has to be said that the country finally rose up in uproar, led by Mary O'Rourke, saying no, no, no.
Over on Liveline, longtime friend John Clark had Nell to thank for getting sober when she confronted him one afternoon. Joe Duffy asked him about that moment and talked also about Nell's relationship with the writer Nuala O'Fuaillon.
What was your reaction to Nell? Did you resist her and say, get lost, leave me alone?
No, I just said, you're right, I'm out. And life turned into a very different life after that, you know. Yeah. A great life.
Yeah.
She said it as a friend. I knew and trusted her as a friend. And
But there's one great vignette, John, I remember about Nuala and Nell. And it was Nell talking about when they would go on holidays. And they would have a limit. There was no Kindle in those days. They would have a limited number of books.
Yeah.
And what they would do is, if Nell would start one book and read three chapters, she would tear out the three chapters and give that to Nuala. So Nuala could be shortly behind. It's an incredible image of affection.
And we'll hear more about Nell McCafferty later in the programme. US Vice President Kamala Harris officially accepted the Democrats' nomination on Thursday night, with Gavin Jennings of Morning Ireland asking Washington correspondent Sean Whelan how she got on.
Ready for the next step in the incredible journey that is America. Kamala Harris, Vice President of the United States, the first woman of colour put forward for the top job, formally accepted the nomination from Democrats overnight.
I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America. Our nation with this election has a precious, fleeting opportunity to move past the bitterness, cynicism, and divisive battles of the past, a chance to chart a new way forward.
Let's cross live to Chicago and our correspondent, Sean Whelan. Well, Sean, did she deliver?
Yes, she did deliver, Gavin. I mean, the first thing you have to do in any big set piece speech like this, that you've been built up and you are the star of the night, is not to foul up in any kind of way. And she didn't foul up in any way. So she delivered on that baseline thing. Then she built on the things that you'd expect her to build on, going through her background and biography, the foundations of her political outlook, how she was shaped as an individual and how her core beliefs inform her views on policy, whether that be economic policy, and you're talking about the influence of her mother. But certainly she wanted to take this opportunity to establish herself as a tough individual, no pushover, in the way that Donald Trump has been presenting her. Again, I think the difference between herself and Joe Biden is not so much what they say, but how they say it, the style of presentation, the force of the presentation, the emotion of the presentation.
45-minute speech, vague calls for unity, calling for a new path forward, policies and generalities, very little detail. Over the last 4 weeks or so, culminating in last night, do Americans know who she is now?
They're knowing a bit more who she is, yeah. And, you know, what they're seeing is broad brushstrokes, obviously. It's the contrast, again, between herself and Joe Biden, and also between herself and Donald Trump. The one thing she didn't play on in any of this was really being a woman or being a woman of colour. She just went out and said, I'm a politician. This is what I believe in. And these are the things I want to concentrate in. And also, this is my experience.
Now, the unofficial voice of South Dublin, Ross O'Carroll Kelly, is to be retired from book writing by Paul Howard after a quarter of a century. The Rossmeister General's last book, Don't Look Back in Anger, is just published. Ray Darcy probed some of the subject matter with Paul Howard.
Is there more sex in this book than the normal ones?
You're not the first person to ask that. What is going on?
There probably is, actually. He's sort of stuck between his ex-wife and his Roz, and he can't stay faithful to either of them as well. What you said is quite. A lot of people have said that to me, that in the early books.
About that. And Mary, your wife, is the first reader of all the books.
Yes.
So how did those chats go?
Yeah, she did say there's an awful lot of sex in this one, isn't there? But yeah, Mary gives me great feedback on the books, and she's been reading them since the very start as well. So that's great to get, you know. And I always, you know, if I hear her laughing, I'll know. I mean, I really annoy her when she's reading, because I'm always going, what bit's that? What's that? I'll do more of that. What's that? It's very strange, actually. You know, I'm sad today because it's the last first publication day of a Ross book, and so everything is sort of a last time.
You're
now
saying goodbye.
You know, it's all these
milestones
of goodbyes. But that's the big one that I've been sort of struggling with all summer. I've had time off, and I haven't had time off since I think the year before I sat my leaving cert was the last time I actually had a summer off. He's been part of my life for since 1998, so it's the greater part of my adult life I've been writing Ross O'Carroll Kelly.
And this is it, without giving too much away,
Please tell Paul how devastated that I won't hear about Ross anymore. Ross has helped me through some dark days. I can't read them in public because I belly laugh. I actually quote Ross and my family remind me that he's not real.
Yes, he is.
I've every one told of them you that. And wouldn't part with them. So thank you, Paul, for all the joy you gave me over the years.
Thank
Isn't
you.
That nice? Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Thanks
a lot,
much.
Ray. Thank you.
Enjoy your book retirement, Ross. Go easy on the high nose. Someone else with a distinctive voice is Sean Kane, who joined KCE on Arena on Wednesday to talk about an upcoming concert with the RTE Concert Orchestra. Sean also spoke about getting the attention of legendary Beatles producer Sir George Martin.
I was recording an album at the time. I was maybe halfway through the recording, half the material recorded. And George Martin heard me sing Blackbird and he said, would you consider singing that on the recording it on your album? And I thought, I said, my answer to him was, well, I hadn't thought about it because a lot of the songs were trad songs or, you know, that kind of, I wasn't sure if Blackbird, a Beatles song, would fit into the rest of the songs that I had recorded. So, about a week later, it actually was a week later, on a Sunday morning, the phone rang. I lifted up the phone and it was George Martin at the other end. And he says, well, are you going to record this song or what? And I said, well, I am. And he said, if you do, he says, I'll give you the arrangement that I put together for the Beatles, the original arrangement, string arrangement, and you can have it. You're welcome to use it. And sure enough, I recorded the song a week later, the arrangements came in the post and we recorded the song.
Blackbird, sing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to arrive. Blackbird, sing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly.
Isn't that just lovely? Back shortly. Welcome back. Brian O'Connell here, sitting in for Sinead. Among the many to pay tribute to Niall McCafferty was broadcaster and journalist Olivia O'Leary, who was on with Today with Claire Byrne and wanted to put Niall's life and legacy in context.
She used to call me Little Olivia, which I thought was a bit extraordinary coming from Little Niall. And we were very different and from very different backgrounds. But I had enormous admiration for her, Claire. I mean, I was looking at the radio schedule this morning. You know, early on, we have Mary Wilson and Audrey Carvel. Then we have you. Then at lunchtime, we have Rachel English. I mean, when I started in RTE, there were very few women on the air in any area that was serious, like politics.
Yeah.
And it was people like Niall, that famous Late Late Show, where she went on with Mary Marr and Mary Holland and Evan Boland. And they just pointed out so many things, like, why have we no female faces on television doing anything serious? So every time I got a chance or a promotion or an opportunity to do something terrific journalistically in my own life, I thanked Niall. And the wonderful thing about Niall was her shock tactics. You know, Niall went in there fighting and she took no prisoners. And the wonderful thing about her was the extent to which she alerted all of us, opened our eyes, even women, to the lack of women's faces in important positions. I mean, when she wrote that book that she wrote about the awful Kerry Babies case and about the tribunal, that one of the pictures in it, and she describes it particularly, is that all the men around, all the men who were interrogating this young woman about her sexual life and morals, they were all men. There wasn't a woman to be seen. Niall was the one who could have kept opening our eyes and pointing out the missing women.
On Wednesday night, Brenda Donoghue's programme Going Home, where Nell spoke about her childhood experiences, was rebroadcast. Here is Nell talking in her parents' bedroom.
I missed the first year in primary school and I missed the third year in primary school. And during those years when I was in the bed, I think for 6 months of the year, but it was during school term, my father would come home at lunchtime. That noise in the background is my mother looking for attention, by the way. My father would come home at lunchtime and teach me my lessons, which I didn't know were lessons. I just thought it was games. I would read comic cuts and books and essays. The reason why I know now it was essays is one time I was writing about George the Postman. He comes round delivering mail and I was writing this little line and I said, George wears a blue suit. And my father said, George wears a blue serge suit. And I said, what's serge? And he explained to me. So then began a life of enchantment with words. That introduced me to tweed, leather, silk. Always I was looking out for these little details. But when my father had finished the essay, my mother then came in and said, and George is married with so many children. And his wife used to be called, and she lived there, and they now live here. And she gave me the actual other human side of the story, complementing that of the working man. So, in a sense, they both educated me.
In this bed?
In this bed, every day, which was kind of really heroic of him, unless he enjoyed it. I know he was meant to be a school teacher once, and for various reasons, to do with, I think, poverty, he had to leave.
Also on Wednesday, actor Brendan Gleeson joined Clare to promote Bewley's Big Coffee Morning for Hospice. And he too wanted to pay tribute to Nell McCafferty and her very direct style.
I met her once and she cut the legs from underneath me, the first thing she said to me. And she said, I suppose you're somebody, you're pretending to be something you're not or something. And I kind of got a shock and I glared at her basically and I said, I'm not going to defend myself to this. But I met her afterwards. She said, you know, I think you're great, by the way. I said, I think you're great too.
And all was well.
And all was well. It was suddenly, but she was just such a force, wasn't she?
Clare also asked Brendan about his upcoming role in a Joker movie, working alongside Joaquin Phoenix.
I wouldn't say I'm exactly the star of the show, but I just was so pleased to get the call to actually to be a part of that setup because the first film completely blew me away. There are very few performances that have affected me to the same extent as Joaquin's in the first film. I remember being unable to speak for about 15 minutes afterwards.
Really?
And it's just, yeah, the depth of it was... Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. And I watched the trailer last night for the new movie because I knew we were having our chat today. And it looks very dark. Like it looks creepy. And those things, I'm not good, Brendan. I'm not good. Like Banshees of Inisherin, great, you know? Nice sunlit vistas. Everyone
I
lives.
Lost all my digits. What are you talking about? Nice sunlit vistas.
It looked nice. It didn't frighten me. The Joker, don't know. I watch it because you're in it, of course.
Honestly, no, I don't know if that's a great idea, but I just.
Ooh, nice recovery there, Claire. On Saturday, former Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, took time out of her busy work schedule to talk to Dervil MacDonald, who was filling in for Brendan. She was asked if she thought America would elect a female president in November.
I think so. Yes, I do. And we're going to make it so. Winning an election is a decision. You make a decision to win, and then you make every decision in favor of winning. How you mobilize at the grassroots level to own the ground, how you message with boldness and progressiveness, but not with menacing messaging and the money to get it done. And the small donors are just raging as they are sending in support for Kamala Harris.
Dervil also asked her about a brutal attack on her husband, Paul, by a hammer-wielding conspiracy theorist.
He's coming along fine. Making progress all along. Terrible for me because the person was after me, came into my house, into our house, into our home, into our bedroom. Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Very familiar from January 6th when they came into the Capitol. Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? What was sad about it was, of course, the physical injury. Very dangerous. A centimeter, as I learned when the doctor testified in court, from being fatal. Could have been fatal, would have been, well, God bless us, he's with us. What was awful about it was the former president and his family and Republican governor and others making a joke of it, making a joke of somebody being physically assaulted.
Yeah.
And then, but so that's where a lot of the trauma sets in. You have trauma because of the attack. But the fact that they would do that, and people would laugh, and they liked it on social media. And so, but hundreds of thousands of people sent their messages of goodwill by their groups or by individually. I never thought we would see the day when under Lincoln's Dome, which Lincoln built, we would see the Confederate flag and all of that horrible assault on our country. Our founders had this beautiful vision. It could not be honored completely in our Constitution, but they put in a process of amendment so that we could ever expand freedom. Lincoln held us together, building that dome during the Civil War to show America's resilience. And now the times had found us. Thomas Paine said the times have found us during the Revolution. Now the times have found us to save our democracy.
Over on Second Captain Saturday, seasoned CNN correspondent John King, who was one of the media stars of the last US election, who can forget his magic wall election map, spoke about his humble Irish-American upbringing.
We didn't have much money. We had almost no money. And they just instilled in us early on, just work hard, be yourself, work hard, be a good person, be an honest person, be a decent person, and remember the people around you.
That work ethic was something I know you put into action very early on, delivering newspapers around your neighborhood as a kid, John. And print journalism was actually where you started out as a reporter as well, before you became a TV superstar.
I did, and I'm grateful I did. I don't know that I'm a TV superstar, but thank you. I have a job that happens to be on television. But I'm very lucky. I was at college, and I think like a lot of kids at university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had a Shakespeare professor who said, you like to write. You should try this journalism thing. So I took a journalism class, and I had a great instructor there who said, I can teach you the basics, but there's only one way to find out if you actually like this, and that's to get it, go do it. And he helped me get an internship at the Wire Service, the Associated Press, and they let me do things when I was done with the stuff I had to do. And all of a sudden, I realized, I was going to court hearings. I was going to legislative hearings. Providence, Rhode Island is where that was at the time. And there's a great, it's illegal, but a very interesting organized crime ring that was based in Providence, Rhode Island. So there were great, exciting stories. Yeah, right? I say these things sometimes. Because he likes the mob. No, I just mean
it's an important clarification.
Yeah. I think you've cleared this one up beautifully. Yeah.
Having supported and encouraged his early career, did his parents get to witness his success?
And my dad died just before Thanksgiving in 1987. And I remember telling my mother, I can't do this. I have to stay home. I have to stay home and be around the family. And she just, again, didn't say much. She just looked at me and she said, what would your father want you to do? I'm going to tear up telling the story. Sorry. But it was, so I did. I went out and I did it. And then my mother died right after the 1992 election. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas. Bill Clinton was the governor then and was the president-elect. When my mother died. But one of my cherished gifts is a note from my mother when I was covering the first Persian Gulf War, when George H.W. Bush was president and Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the world came together to kick him out. I was the only reporter that snuck into this little town called Kafji that the Iraqis had actually crossed into Saudi Arabia. And the American military denied they were there. The Saudis denied they were there. But because I and another Associated Press colleague went up there, we documented the story. They had to admit that all that was true. And so an American television network interviewed me and put me on television. And I got essentially a three-paragraph note from my mother, who my handwriting is horrible. My mother had the most beautiful handwriting I could ever imagine. And it just, it just said, your father would be very proud of you. Stay safe. Please come home now. I keep it folded up because it's just one of the most cherished things I have.
So how much of a sporting wise guy was John King? Well, the captains tried to find out.
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender.
Your mammoth 14-hour shifts manning the magic wall on election night tells me you've got some toughness about you. You're a steely-eyed competitor. When it comes to toughness and Boston, they don't get any tougher than Ted Williams, who fought in two wars and still found time to be one of the greatest baseball players of all time. and it was precisely that quality that was needed to close out your 150-mile cycle along the rugged coastline of New England, a feat that old Ted himself would surely have been proud. Throw in your beautiful show of solidarity with a childhood friend, and the points are really starting to add up. So much so that I'm now ready to call today's score. There are no hanging chads here, no misplaced ballots. It's 82 points, good enough for joint second place. John King, this has been your Sporting Life.
You're only behind Brendan Gleeson, John, so you got to be happy with that.
This would be quite controversial in today's day and age, but I respect the count of the judges. even though I wish I would come in first place, I trust the accountability and the accuracy of the system.
John, you've been absolutely amazing. Can't wait to see loads of you over the next few months. A round of applause, please. Thank you so much to John King.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Also making sporting waves in recent weeks was 91-year-old tennis player June Ann Byrne, who's been playing the sport for some 8 decades. She told Ray Darcy about some of her earliest memories and the secrets to her longevity.
I was born when Ireland was still attached to the Commonwealth.
Wherever you competed, brought an Irish flag with you.
I did. They flew everywhere.
And you insisted that it fly you.
Yes.
What age did you finish playing sort of competitively? I know you were playing...
Only when I was 85 or 6. Right. Yeah. There's no over 90s now.
Is there not?
No. But if I... World Tennis said to me, if I go get a view from some other countries, they'd run it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just great. I've met the nicest people that ever.
But so we'll put a call in, will we? For anybody over 90s.
You're too young for mixed doubles, man. You're too young, yeah.
So 91 and still flying it.
Yeah.
And of course... Exercise is a huge, I'd imagine, huge part
of it.
And
you know what? I'm so proud of all our Olympians. Do you know, I was dancing around the TV. Yeah.
What advice do you give to people? Because I know it's a pain in a way, but when you get to your age, people want advice on longevity,
don't they? Well, I think they should
they?
Take advice when they're about 25 or 30. Honestly, when they come to my age, it's a bit old.
It's a bit late.
It's a bit, yeah. Number one, give up heavy drinking, overeating and smoking. That's all I can say.
It's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
No, no.
This week, the Road Safety Authority came in for some criticism when an advertising campaign was accused of being ableist by some. On Morning Ireland, Gavin Jennings asked Green Party TD Nasa Harrigan what the issue was.
When you lose your licence, you become reliant on other people to take you where you need to go and you become a burden for others, part of the Road Safety Authority's latest ad campaign aimed at young drivers between 16 and 25. It focuses on the loss of a driving licence as a motive for safer driving. Nasa Harrigan is here. She's Green Party TD for Dublin Central and spokesperson for Finance, Public Expenditure and Health. What's the problem with an ad campaign aimed at essentially saving lives?
There's absolutely no problem with an ad campaign, particularly one that focuses on young drivers, male drivers, who we know in terms of the data are more likely to be involved in accidents. And there's also no issue, I think, with saying that if you lose your licence, it could be very disruptive to you, because a lot of people build their lives around their mode of transport, whether that's cycling or walking or driving. There's a big jump between that and saying that people who don't drive are a burden. And the tagline of that is, you lose your licence, you lose your independence. Now, That is a difficult point to make. And I think there are a huge amount of people in this country, through no fault of their own or through choice, who don't drive and who are not a burden to us. Our family and friends who don't drive are not a burden. They're not a problem. There are people with epilepsy, with neurological disorders, with visual impairment, with mobility issues, who cannot drive. And to put that out there culturally, that people are a burden if you don't, I think it is a problem. And this is a state-funded agency.
Niamh called in to Liveline and detailed her own frustration with the campaign.
I'm a young woman with a disability. I use a wheelchair. Okay. And when I saw this advert, I was very, I've thought about the word, but disappointed, let's go with. I mean,
okay.
Ableism is so prevalent in society, and see this ad that kind of perpetuates this idea that I often have about myself, you know, because I do use a wheelchair, I don't have a license, I'm unable to drive, so I have to ask my parents for a lift. It was very disappointing and upsetting to me. It's very obvious there's a problem with young male drivers when they put out an ad campaign like this, you have to remember that nearly a quarter of Ireland's population identify as having some sort of disability. So in targeting that specific group of young male drivers, they're completely alienating a quarter of the population from their ad campaign.
And that was Niamh talking to Joe. Back shortly. Welcome back. Fake News and Irish Freedom, an eight-part series from RTÉ's History Show team, looked at censorship, propaganda and fake news, as we might call it today. We heard about an Irish newspaper created by Dáil Éireann in November 1919 as a means to publicise the cause of an independent Ireland. The British responded by creating a new public information section in Dublin Castle, managed by an experienced English journalist named Basil Clark, as historian Ian Kennelly explains.
Clark would go on to become a leading figure in the establishment of the public relations industry in Britain. But while he's in Ireland, he's in charge of what's called the public information branch or public information department in some sources. It's similar in some respects to what the Americans had done during the First World War with George Creel and the Committee on Public Information, which is often seen as, you know, one of the forerunners of modern propaganda schemes. Clark is a serious figure. He institutes, or he tries to institute, a system he calls propaganda by news, which means that news should be relayed to the media and to the public in what's seen as a matter-of-fact style. It shouldn't be embellished. It should not be seen to be obviously ludicrous or false in any way. He even uses the term in one report, verisimilitude, and that is to give the appearance of truth. So from Clark's perspective, a story may not be entirely accurate, but as long as it has the appearance of being accurate, that's more than enough.
Much like today, in the 1920s, journalism was undergoing a period of scrutiny and self-examination.
In the aftermath of the First World War, there's a sense amongst journalists, particularly in Britain, I think, that they have somehow disgraced their profession during the First World War, when they became effectively government spokespersons and became part of that huge propaganda apparatus, and now they're seeking to reclaim the honour of their profession. And you can see that in newspaper reports regarding the public information branch that Clark has established. The Manchester Guardian talks about doped news, as in news that's been drugged or is trying to drug the audience. Similar language is used by the London Times. And the Times goes so far as to say that news doesn't become more accurate just because it's official. So you have this real scepticism on the British side towards Clark's work, and on the Irish side, Irish journalists, because it's an official news source coming out of Dublin Castle, are of course inherently sceptical as well. And for them, Clark's work is seen as a bit of a joke, and he becomes known to Irish journalists as the black and tan publicity man.
And censorship was also dealt with in Bowman Sunday, the fascinating weekly excavation of the archives, which on Sunday looked back at the work of novelist Kate O'Brien, marking the 50th anniversary of her death. As a postscript to a previous edition, John Bowman examined her relationship with the Irish Censorship Board in the 1940s.
I object to censorship. It's as simple as that. I think it's a foolish imposition. I mean, people have always had the ordinary censorships of decent society that prevail, and there's religion and conscience and the law. And it seems to me, if we can't manage with those weapons to protect ourselves from what we object to or what we believe to be evil, it's ridiculous for a set of laymen to turn around and say that they know better than all the rest of the laymen what's to be read or what's to be listened to or what's to be done.
This disdain for the censorship laws as being foolish anticipates the attitude that was later taken by John McGarren.
You have suffered yourself from our system of censorship.
I've been censored, yes. I don't know whether I've suffered, but I've been censored. Two of my books, one has not been unbanned, but the second one, The Land of Spices, which they censored very severely here, in the war, I wasn't here, in 43, I think. That eventually was unbanned. Sean O'Fallon and other friends and admirers of the book and friends of mine fought a great battle. It went on for 2 or 3 years.
Towards the end of her writing life, Kate O'Brien was aware that her books were not as fashionable and not as widely circulated as once they had been.
Ah, well, of course, one goes out of fashion, and my kind of book isn't as much liked as it used to be, but that's inevitable. All writers have to go through that. And I don't think my rather quiet analytical young Catholic lady's love affairs are of great interest to the vast majority of the world now, but they're still red, I believe. I do my best, but I'm a bit out of fashion, and that doesn't surprise me at all.
The role of the artist and of built heritage was taken up by Cork poet Theo Dorgan on Sunday Miscellany. Dorgan drew his inspiration on the plans for a Poetry Ireland Centre at 11 Parnell Square, a building with generations of stories to tell.
Every word in a poem, says Boris Pasternak, must carry the ghosts of its own past. We inherit language. It comes down to us like a river. And the poet's business is to keep the water clear, to speak of the present moment in the present moment, using words that have come down to us from the ancestors. The past, if we are alive to it, is always an element in the living present. For a long time, we in Ireland did not fully understand that the built environment, the fabric of roads, homes and public buildings, was also a living inheritance, a gift from the past that could come alive in the present, could be put to new uses. This is to be a building for the whole of Ireland, embodying and celebrating a diversity of traditions, providing for the new and the unexpected, the repurposing of who we are and who we want to be. And so the river of inheritance rolls on, carrying us with it into what we must make of the living present, the future we must make together.
And sticking with our built landscape, using homes for short-term tourist lettings came up on Liveline, in particular, the growing site of lockboxes in Dublin city centre.
John, Airbnb, what's the issue?
I live in Dublin inner city, and over the years, our terrace of 23 houses has now got 5 Airbnbs, and we have a situation where we're taking out family homes and giving them to tourists. And
what we were getting, just I mentioned it last week, what we were getting phone calls about last week are these new lockboxes, which are a lot of people have them on the side of their own homes. They're very sturdy, and now you can buy ones that can be wrapped around a pole or something sturdy on the street. Have you noticed them, by the way?
Yes, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of those on Dublin Street, attached to railings, to lampposts.
Okay.
And each lockbox that you see on a railing or on a bike park or on a lamppost, that's a landlord deciding to lock someone out of a home because he's decided, or in many cases it's the company that owns the property, they've decided they don't want office workers, they don't want families, they want to make their home available to tourists. And you have a situation where there's thousands of these. I went on Airbnb, which is the main platform. There was, in Dublin, there was 862 houses available in the middle of a housing crisis for tourists, but aren't available for the people. So it's a pain in the neck living beside holiday lets. Between antisocial behaving, I remember one time, 3 o'clock in the morning, there's people kicking in the door next door trying to get in because one of the guys had got in early, fell asleep drunk. They were trying to kick the door in to get his attention. We have situations where if you're antisocial in a hotel, they'll kick you out, but you can be as antisocial as you like in an Airbnb. There's no consequences. There's no one to complain to.
An issue which caused tension in government this week was plans to defer a zoned land tax. Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty agreed this tax should never have applied to farmland, as he told Cormac on Drive Time.
Last year in the finance bill, the government voted to defer this tax because this tax was supposed to apply on the 1st of January this year. It was supposed to free up land where speculators and developers are hoarding land, looking at the value going up. We've been very clear in this year. When this was first introduced, when it was first legislated for, we said there was an issue in terms of active farming. I've made it very, very clear to the government when they designed this legislation that there was a problem with farmers. And when the government came forward last year to defer this for a full year, I said that this is crazy. Let's bring out active farmers from the legislation and make sure that those who are genuinely hoarding land are actually dealt with.
Later in the programme, Cork property developer Michael O'Flynn took issue with the idea developers were sitting on huge swathes of zoned land. But he did concede a generation of prospective homeowners are being failed.
As an industry, we are in favour of the concept of a zoning tax,
but it has to be implied in such a way that it's equitable. And obviously, farmers have made their point and made it very strongly. Land is our core raw material. We need land zoned and we need land available. I'm not aware of any land being hoarded at this moment in time by people in my business. We're not in the business of hoarding land. We're in the business of development. And those issues that you think can be easily resolved could take months. And some of those have taken years. And I have zoned land for decades that haven't still been resolved from the point of view of infrastructure. It depends on the infrastructure. And it depends on whether they're national roads or local roads and all of that.
But if it's zoned and if planning permission is granted, those services, my point is, would be, given the housing crisis that we have, would be brought to the site. And then the land tax is applicable. And your point in terms of you don't know of anyone hoarding land, it's important for the people who can't afford to buy a house in the market as it currently stands. And they say they believe, and various experts believe, that any increase in supply would help them.
Cormac, I'm well on record for saying we are failing a generation of people, because when I was building houses first 40 years ago, plus at this stage, we could supply housing to people, be they single or couples, at a price that they could afford to buy. We are failing a generation of people, absolutely, at this moment in time. If we don't deal with this, we're going to add to the cost of housing and we're not going to add to the housing stock.
Now, in case you haven't heard, Ireland's latest online sensation is Kildare woman Paula Jones, who attended an Adele concert in Munich and was brought up on stage by the singer in front of 80,000 people. Why? Well, because she looked a bit of crack. Paula and Adele quickly became besties, and as well as gaining a friend for life, Paula also received a goodie bag. She told Oliver Callan what was in it.
Good morning, Paula.
Hello, Oliver. Good morning to you. How are you? And thank you so much for inviting me on.
We really wanted to chat to you because, as Adele has listed you, the most excitable and fun person she has met ever, I think. I'm glad to hear you've calmed down somewhat.
I think I'm still floating on a fluffy cloud, but yes, I'm trying to control the adrenaline that is somewhat still in my body. It was just the most surreal experience ever, meeting my idol. Seeing her in concert live, but then out of 80,000 people to join her on stage. I mean, it's a pinch me moment.
You are literally jumping up and down.
Oh my goodness, I couldn't stop. Absolutely, I couldn't stop. I mean, it was just my natural, honest reaction to meeting Adele.
That's why
she was like
loved.
My best buddy. You know, she was just like, but that's Adele. She's just so adorable. She's so approachable. She's a beautiful person. She's so stunning. And like, you can have the crack with her. I just hung out with her like she's my best buddy.
You were never going to let her go. You were never going to let her go.
No, I wasn't. Holding on for dear life. So I got a beautiful tote bag, and inside that bag there was the most amazing signed brochure from Adele that has stunning photographs of her. And I got some Adele t-shirts. I got a digital camera, some Adele Haribos. So she had branded her own Haribo jellies, as you do. And I got some magnets and some pins and some other small trinkets. But it was just amazing.
Your sunglasses have now been worn by Adele, so they're now very important accessories.
I know. How mad is that? My sunglasses worn by Adele,
Music can be very subjective, as DJ and broadcaster Crossy highlighted when he took Claire Byrne through the Marmite music we love to hate, from Coldplay to Taylor Swift. Claire, though, was having none of his insubordination when it came to Queen Bey.
The next one, I think, is controversial. Really controversial, because I don't think this person belongs on the list of Marmite artists.
Really?
No, I don't. No, I don't. Don't agree. This ain't Texas. Ain't no hold 'em. Hey, lay your card down, 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 down. So pop your letters. Throw your keys out. Problem with Beyonce.
I'm going to agree to this one, right? Okay. So I put this up on my Instagram, right? And I says, what are the acts or bands that people don't, you know, that you don't like, but everyone seems to love and adore? Yeah. This came in at number one. Beyonce came in at number one. And it was mostly girls. Right? It was mostly girls that said it. Here's some of the comments that I got, right? And a lot of these people are in the media industry. I don't get the hype. She thinks she's God. Beyonce can't stand her. She's so full of herself. If she was crisp, she'd eat herself. Another one, I cringe when I see people over obsessing over her. I respect her, but please stop it. And then finally, loved early Beyonce, but now she just believes in her own hype, so puts out any old trash.
I thought she was so godlike that you weren't permitted to say any of those things.
And is that the reason why that when people think of Beyonce, you know, if you love her, you're Queen Bey and everything about her, you're going to go to all her tour. Is it the fact that she's never come, she hasn't come to Ireland in a couple of years? Are Irish people just kind of going, oh, Beyonce.
I went to her gig the last time she was here in Croke Park. It was the best thing I have ever seen. Okay. Now, I haven't been to, I'm not a person who goes to gigs a lot, but it was like you were holding your breath for the whole thing. It was extraordinary.
Do you think, though, have you ever heard her speak? She doesn't do interviews.
Not really, but I don't want to hear them.
Do you not
want
to hear her? I want to know everything about her.
Really.
I want her to go, hey, you guys, on Instagram.
She had that big documentary that she did. Do you remember that? On Apple or something. And I heard her speak plenty in that. But, I mean, it didn't add to her music. Do you know what I mean? I'm not that interested in what she has to say, but she's an incredible performer.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Isn't that just mad that we've completely... Cause, and there's going to be people listening right now going, how dare you say that about Beyonce?
Oh, 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 oh. Till next week.